to see. She looked down at her two necklaces, expecting to see the stones shining brightly as they had when she awoke from that terrible vision in the Almont. But they were dark. The last time she remembered seeing them illuminated had been that night in the Argive Pass, when she had brought the flood. For the first time, Kelsey wondered if it was possible that the jewels had somehow burned out. They had worked a great and extraordinary miracle in the Argive, but it seemed to have drained everything from them. Perhaps they were no more than ordinary jewels now. The idea brought relief, followed quickly by fear. The Mort were massing on the border, and any weapon would help, even one as inconsistent and unpredictable as her two jewels. They could not burn out. "You should go to bed, lady," Penn told her. Kelsey nodded slowly, still turning the extraordinary vision over in her mind. Out of habit, she ran a hand across the row of books, taking comfort in their solidity. Sleepwalking or not, she was not surprised that this was where she'd ended up. Whenever she had a problem to consider, she invariably found herself in the library, for it was easier to think when she was surrounded by books. The clean, alphabetized rows provided something to stare at and consider while her mind wandered away. Carlin, too, had used her library as both solace and refuge, and Kelsey thought Carlin would be pleased that she found the same comfort here. Pinpricks of tears stung her eyes, but she turned away from the bookshelf and led Penn out of the library. Andalai was waiting for Kelsey in her chamber, though the clock showed that it was well after 3 in the morning. Her youngest daughter, Glee, was asleep in her arms. "Andalai, it's late. You should have gone to bed."
"I was awake anyway, lady. My Glee has been sleepwalking again."
"Ah." Kelsey slipped off her shoes. "A cunning sleepwalker, I hear. Mace says he found her wandering in the guard quarters last week."
"The mace says many things, lady."
Kelsey raised her eyebrows. The tone had been judgmental, but she couldn't interpret the remark. "Well, I don't need help tonight. You should go to bed." Andalai nodded and left, carrying her small daughter with her. Once she was gone, Penn bowed and said, "Good night, lady."
"You don't have to bow to me, Penn."
Humour sparked in Penn's eyes, but he said nothing, only bowed again before retreating into his anteroom and drawing the curtain. Kelsey took off her dress and tossed it into the clothes hamper. She was glad that Andalai had gone so easily. Sometimes Andalai seemed to feel it was her duty to help Kelsey get undressed, but Kelsey didn't think she would ever be comfortable being naked in front of others. Andalai had hung a full-length mirror on the wall beside Kelsey's dresser, but as she was trying to quietly cure Kelsey of her physical shyness, she had picked the wrong tack. Even this simple device created myriad challenges. Kelsey wanted to look in the mirror, but she didn't want to, and she always ended up looking, and then hated herself. Her reflection did not please her, especially since moving into the Queen's Wing, where it seemed she was surrounded by beautiful women. But even stronger was distaste for her mother, Queen Alyssa, who had reportedly spent half of her life preening in front of the glass. So Kelsey made a compromise. Whenever she passed the mirror, she would glance at herself quickly, just long enough to determine that her hair was all right and she hadn't wiped ink on her face during the day. Anything more than a peek would be vanity. Now, catching sight of herself in the mirror, Kelsey froze. She had dropped weight. This seemed impossible, for Kelsey was even less active now than when she had first come to the keep. There was too much to do every day, and most of it involved sitting, either on her throne or at her desk in the library. She hadn't exercised in weeks, and all of her plans to eat less, which seemed so attainable in the morning, were inevitably wrecked by nightfall. But she could not deny what she was seeing now. Her thick legs had slimmed down, and her hip bones were more pronounced. Her stomach, which had always been a special source of embarrassment due to the dimpling that showed just above her abdomen, had retreated to only a slight rounded protrusion. Kelsey tiptoed closer to the mirror, peering at her arms. They too seemed thinner. The thick meat had disappeared from her biceps, and now they tapered neatly down to her forearms. But when had all of this happened? Less than a week ago, certainly, for she had peeked into the mirror before her last meeting with Hall and seen none of these changes. Staring at her face, Kelsey got a nasty shock, for it seemed that something was different there, too. But a moment later, she realized that it had been only a trick of the firelight. What's wrong with me? Should she ask Mace to get the doctor? She shrank from the idea. Mace didn't think anyone needed a doctor unless he was bleeding to death. And the Mort doctor favored by Corin was wildly expensive. Was Kelsey really going to demand him now simply because she'd lost some weight? She wasn't wounded or bleeding. She felt fine. She could afford to watch and wait. And if anything else happened, then she would tell Mace or Pen. She had been under a great deal of stress lately, after all. The fire snapped behind her, and Kelsey whirled around. For a moment, she was certain that someone was standing in front of the fireplace, watching her. But there was nothing, only shadows. Despite the fire's warmth, her chamber suddenly seemed cold. After a final uneasy look in the mirror, Kelsey put on her nightgown and climbed into bed. She blew out her candle, then dug her feet deep into the warm pile of blankets, pulling the covers all the way up to cover her cold nose. She tried to relax, but behind her closed eyes, unbidden, came the same image that had tormented her for weeks now. The Mort army, a poisonous black tide that poured down over the border hills into the Almont, leaving devastation behind. The Mort had not entered the Tier, not yet, but they would. Mace and Arliss had been stocking for siege and building reinforcements around the city. But unlike Bermond, Kelsey didn't deceive herself. When the Mort really came for the city and put all of their efforts into breaching the walls, no amount of last-minute fortification would keep them out. Her mind turned again to Lily Mayhew, who lived in a town surrounded by walls. There must be some lesson in Lily's life. Something helpful. But nothing came. Kelsey rolled onto her back, staring into the darkness. Her mother had faced the same no-win scenario and ended up selling out the Tierling. Kelsey hated her for it, yes. But what could she do differently? She clutched her sapphires, willing them to give her answers. But they were silent, imparting only a feeling of doomed certainty. Kelsey had judged her mother harshly, and this was the inevitable punishment, to be dealt the same hand. I have no solutions, Kelsey thought, curling up into a ball. And if I can think of nothing, then I'm no better than she was. The miners were a rough lot. They had obviously bathed before coming to the keep, but nevertheless dirt seemed to have grimed its way into their skins, giving them a swarthy appearance. They were independent miners, and this in itself was something of a rarity. Most of the miners in the Tierling belonged to guilds, for combination was the only way they could compete against the Mort. One of the miners was a woman, tall and blonde, though she was as grimy as the rest, and wore a beaten green hat that looked as though it had been through a hurricane. Kelsey, who hadn't known that mining crews accepted women, watched her with interest. But the woman returned her gaze with hostility.
"Majesty, we're just out of the Fairwitch," announced Bennett, the foreman. "We've been mining in the foothills for nearly a month."
Kelsey nodded, wishing she hadn't worn such a thick wool dress. Summer had come, warm and somnolent. But someone had lit a fire anyway. She hated holding audience these days, for it seemed designed to take her attention away from the more pressing problems, the Mort and the refugees. The first wave of border villagers would already be making their way across the Almont, but they were only a fraction of what was coming. 500,000 extra people at least. Where would New London put them all?
"We were originally a crew of 15, Majesty," Bennett continued, and Kelsey tried to keep her attention on him, stifling a yawn.
"Where are the rest?"
"Gone, lady. In the night. We kept a pretty close camp even at first, but, well, you know, a man has to take a piss sometimes. Men would leave the camp in the night, and sometimes they just didn't come back."
"And why have you come to tell me this?" Bennett began to reply, but the female miner, who had the air of a second in command, grabbed his arm, muttering frantically into his ear. The exchange quickly became a protracted argument, punctuated by grunts and hissing. Kelsey was content to watch. Father Tyler stood closer to the miners than the rest of them. He could probably hear what was being said. She had begun to allow the priest to attend her audiences on occasion, and he had already provided several valuable insights. He enjoyed the audiences, said it was like watching history in action. He also knew how to keep his mouth shut, so much so that he had reportedly incurred the wrath of the new Holy Father, who didn't feel that Father Tyler was providing him with enough information. Kelsey didn't understand what held Father Tyler's tongue, but attendance here seemed like a fair reward.
"Majesty."
Bennett finally broke free, though his companion glared at him as he spoke.
"We found something in the Fairwitch."
"Yes?" Bennett nudged the woman, who gave him a disgusted look, but pulled a small black pouch from the pocket of her cloak. Kelsey's guard tightened automatically, doubling up in a line in front of Penn. Something winked blue as Bennett held it up in the torchlight. "What is it?"
"Sapphire, Majesty. Unless I miss my guess. We found a good-sized vein."
Now Kelsey understood the argument.
"I assure you, your find is your own.
We may try to buy it from you at a fair price, but on my word, there will be no seizure." The words had the desired effect. All of the miners seemed to relax at once. Even Bennett's second-in-command calmed down, her brow smoothing as she doffed her green hat.
"May we inspect your find?"
Bennett looked back to the miners, who gave grudging nods. He moved forward a few feet and held the jewel out to Kibb, who took it and brought it to Kelsey. She held up one of her own sapphires to inspect them side by side. Bennett's jewel was rough, chipped directly from the vein, and had seen no polishing. But it was also enormous, almost the size of Kelsey's palm, and there was no mistaking the quality of the stone. She waited a moment, struck by a ridiculous hope that the new sapphire would react to her jewels, wake them up somehow. But nothing happened.
"Lazarus?"
"Looks the same stone to me, but what of it?"
"You say you found a lot of this stuff, Bennett?"
"Yes, Majesty. We had to dig deep for the vein in the foothills, but I would guess it's shallower up in the Fairwitch proper. We just didn't dare go up there after Tober."
"What happened to Tober?"
"Gone, Majesty."
"He deserted?"
"To where?" an old miner in the back asked scornfully. "We had all the supplies."
"Well, what do you think happened then?"
"I don't rightly know, but we heard noises out there in the night sometimes, like some big animal."
"Only some of us heard it, lady,"
Bennett cut in, glaring at the old miner.
"Out in the woods and away up in the Eye of Fairwitch. It was a big thing, but it moved too stealthy to be an ordinary animal. It took Tober. We're sure of it."
"Why?"
"We found his clothing, lady, and his boots, a few days later at the bottom of a ravine. They was all tore up and stained with blood."
Alice snorted quietly, a sound of disbelief.
"Three other men disappeared also, lady, before we learned to tighten up our camp at night and work only in groups. We never found a trace of them."
Kelsey turned the sapphire over in her hand. Alice couldn't know it, but this wasn't the first such story she'd heard lately. Now that there was no shipment, the census people stationed in every village were anxious to prove that they were still relevant, and information of all sorts poured into Mace from every corner of the kingdom, including the tiny villages at the base of the Fairwitch. There had been 3 complaints of missing children in the foothills, as well as several men and women disappeared on the fells. No one had seen anything. Whatever the predator was, it came in the night and then simply vanished with its prey. "Kib, return this, please." Kelsey handed him the stone and leaned back against the throne, thinking. "Lazarus, there have always been disappearances in the Fairwitch, yes?"
"Plenty of them, lady. It's a dangerous place, particularly for children. Scores of young ones disappeared before Tyr families simply stopped settling in the mountains. The Mort, more or less, avoid their portion of the Fairwitch as well."
"Majesty,"
Father Tyler spoke up tentatively, raising his hand in the air, and Kelsey bit back a grin.
"Yes?"
"The old Holy Father believed the Fairwitch to be cursed."
Mace rolled his eyes, but Father Tyler ploughed on.
"I don't believe in curses, but I will tell you. In the late 1st century, the Arvath sent missionaries up into the Fairwitch, looking for those who drifted up there after the crossing and settled in the mountains. None of the missionaries ever returned. This isn't merely rumour. The report is part of the Arvath records."
"Has anyone ever found any bodies?" Kelsey asked.
"Not to my knowledge. This is the first I've heard of any remains at all. Blood or clothing."
This made Kelsey even more uneasy. If people had disappeared, where were the bones? She turned back to the miners. "Bennett, do you plan to return to the Fairwitch?"
"We haven't decided yet, Majesty. The sapphire is good quality, but the risk..."
Arliss tapped Kelsey's shoulder and leaned forward to murmur in her ear.
"The Cadarees value sapphire highly, Majesty. This stuff would be a good investment."
Kelsey nodded, turning to the miners. "Your choice is your own. But should you go back, I'll buy your haul at..." She looked to Arliss.
£50 per kilo.
£60 per kilo. I'll also pay extra for any information on what stalks up there."
"How much extra?"
"It depends on the quality of the information, doesn't it?"
"Give us a moment, Majesty."
Bennett led his crew to the far side of the room, where they gathered into a huddle. The old miner on the outskirts prepared to spit on the floor, and was forestalled only when Welmer grabbed his shoulder and gave him a forbidding shake of the head.
£60 per kilo," Arliss moaned in an undertone.
"You'll make no money that way."
"I know you, Arliss. Your markup is ruthless."
"The right price is whatever the market will bear, Queenie. The ruler of a poor kingdom should remember that."
"Just do your job and make sure the taxes come in on time, old man."
"Old man? You've never had a better tax collector. £10,000 this month alone." "Majesty."
Bennett stood at the foot of the dais.
"It's a fair deal. We'll leave next Friday."
"Good," Kelsey replied. "Arliss, give them each £5 bonus in advance."
£5 each, Queenie?"
"Good will, Arliss."
"Much appreciated, Majesty," said Bennett.
The rest of the miners grunted agreement, crowding around Arliss with hungry expressions. Arliss pulled out his little book and bag of coins, grumbling the entire time, but Kelsey considered the money well spent. The Tierling didn't have enough metal in the ground to support more than a handful of mining crews. If miners disappeared from the Tier, the kingdom would be forced to get the bulk of its metal from Mort Main, which meant there would be no metal at all. A loud yawn came from Kelsey's left. Pen. He was very tired. His eyes had a dark, hollow look about them, and he seemed to have lost weight. "Pen, are you ill?"
"No, lady."
For a moment, Kelsey was reminded of Myrne, whose chronic exhaustion had hidden an addiction to morphia. She blinked and saw deep scarlet blood dripping over her knife hand, then shook her head to clear it. Pen would never be so stupid.
Well, have you been sleeping enough?
Certainly.
Pen smiled, a private type of smile that had nothing to do with the conversation. And in that moment, Kelsey became sure of something she'd only suspected. Pen had a woman somewhere. 2 weekends a month, Mace took Pen's place in the antechamber. Queen's guards didn't usually get time off, but a close guard was a special matter, since he had no downtime. Mace was good company, but Kelsey could always sense Pen's absence. She'd been wondering lately what he did in his spare time, and now, somehow, she knew. A woman, Kelsey thought, a trifle bleakly. She could ask Mace about it, surely he would know. But then she cut that impulse off at the knees. It wasn't her business, no matter how curious she was. She didn't know why she felt so unhappy, for it wasn't Pen she thought of at night. But he was always there, and she had grown to depend on him. She didn't like the idea of him spending time with anyone else. She'd been staring at Pen so long and so alertly that he straightened up in his chair now, looking alarmed. What? Nothing, Kelsey muttered, ashamed of herself. Get more sleep if you can.
Yes, lady.
Once the miners had received their coin, they bowed and followed Bennett away. The money had enlivened them, for they chattered like children as they headed for the doors. Kelsey leaned back in her chair and found a steaming mug of tea sitting on the table beside her.
You're a wonder, Andalai. Not really, lady. I've yet to see the moment when you don't want tea.
Sir,
Kib appeared in the front of the throne, an envelope in his hand.
Colonel Hall's latest report from the border.
Mace took the envelope and offered it to Kelsey, who had just picked up her tea.
I don't have hands. Just read it to me, Lazarus.
Mace nodded stiffly, then began to open the envelope. Kelsey noticed small red spots blooming in his cheeks and wondered if she should have said please. Mace stared at the message for a very long time.
What is it?
Majesty.
Father Tyler jumped forward so unexpectedly that several of Kelsey's guard moved forward to intercept him, and he backed off, hands in the air.
I'm sorry. I'd forgotten. I have a message from the Holy Father.
Can it wait?
No, lady. The Holy Father wishes to have dinner with your Majesty.
Ah. Kelsey narrowed her eyes. I thought he might have some complaints.
I wouldn't know, lady.
Father Tyler replied, but his eyes darted away from hers.
I'm only the messenger. But I wondered if the Mace and I might sort it out now, before I need to leave.
Kelsey was not anxious to meet the new Holy Father, whose priests had already begun to give entire sermons on her shortcomings, her lack of faith, her socialist taxation policies, her early failure to get married and begin breeding an heir.
What if I don't want to dine with him?
Lady.
Mace shook his head.
The Holy Father's a bad enemy to have. And you may need the Arvath if it comes to siege.
For what?
Housing, lady. It's the second largest building in New London.
He was right, Kelsey realized, though the idea of requesting assistance from God's church made her skin break out in goose flesh. She put down her tea. Fine. Give me that letter, Lazarus, and work it out with the good father. Let's have his holiness in here as soon as possible. Mace gave her the paper and then turned to Father Tyler, who visibly quailed, backing away. Kelsey scanned the letter and then looked up, pleased.
We've scored a tactical victory on the Mort Flats. The Mort camp is disbanded. Colonel Hall estimates their recovery time at 2 weeks.
Good news, Majesty, Elston remarked.
Not all good news, Kelsey replied, reading further. The Mort supply route remains intact. The cannons are undamaged.
Still, you're playing for time, Pen reminded her. D- Delay is important.
Playing for time. Kelsey looked around the room and saw, or fancied she saw, the same question in every face. When the time ran out, what then? There was no anxiety here. Her guard clearly expected her to produce another miracle, as she had in the Argive. Kelsey wished she could hide from them, from the calm trust in their eyes. Mace finished up with Father Tyler and returned to his place beside the throne. The priest raised his hand in farewell to Kelsey, and she waved back as he headed off toward the doors.
"What's next?" she asked Mace.
"A group of nobles is waiting outside to see you."
Kelsey closed her eyes.
"I hate nobles, Lazarus."
"That's why I thought it best to deal with them quickly, lady."
When the nobles entered, Kelsey was struck first by their clothing, ostentatious as ever. Now in summer, there were no hats or gloves. But they all displayed a new fashion that Kelsey had seen before. What appeared to be gold and silver melted down and allowed to run in rivulets across the fabric, so that shirts and dresses seemed to be dripping with precious metal. To Kelsey's eye, the effect was merely sloppy, but clearly they thought otherwise. Carlin would have had much to say about this bunch. Despite the fact that she had been a noble herself, she loathed conspicuous consumption. Kelsey was not surprised to see the tall, wasp-like figure of Lady Andrews near the front of the group, cloaked in red silk. She looked, if possible, even more fleshless than before, but that might only have been the look in the woman's eyes, a loathing for Kelsey that seemed to dwarf everything else in her face.
"Majesty."
The man in front, a tiny creature with an enormous beer belly, bowed before her.
"Lord Williams," Mace murmured.
"Greetings, Lord Williams. What can I do for you?"
"We come with a common grievance, Majesty."
Lord Williams swept an arm toward the group behind him.
"All of us hold property in the Almont."
"Yes?"
"The evacuation is already incredibly destructive. Soldiers and refugees march across our land flattening the crops. Some of the refugees even loot in our fields. The soldiers do nothing."
Kelsey bit down on her tongue, realizing that she should have foreseen this issue. These people, after all, had nothing to do but sit and count every last penny of profit. "Do you have complaints of violence, Lord Williams? Armed thievery? Harassment of your farmers?" Lord Williams's eyes widened.
"No, lady, of course not. But we lose money on the damaged and stolen crops, as well as lost work time."
"I see." Kelsey smiled, though it hurt her face. "What would you suggest?"
"Majesty, it's not really my place."
"Speak plainly."
"Well, I..."
Another noble stepped forward, a taller man with a tightly clipped moustache. After a moment's thought, Kelsey placed him. "Lord Evans, who owned vast fields of corn north of the drylands."
"I have reports, lady, that while your soldiers protect the refugees on their journey, they make no attempt to supervise them. You could order better enforcement."
"I will do that. Anything else?"
"My farmers can't work with an army of vagrants marching across their fields. Why not conduct the evacuation at night? That way it won't interrupt production."
Something flared behind Kelsey's ribs. "Lord Evans, I suppose you have a residence in New London?"
"Why, yes, Majesty. My family owns two."
"So long before the mort come, you will simply move your household and all your valuables into town?"
"For certain, Majesty."
"How convenient for you. But these people are being transplanted from their homes with no such ease. Some of them have never left their villages before. Most will be on foot, and many are carrying infants and young children. Are you honestly suggesting that I force them to cross unfamiliar territory in the dark?"
Of course not, Your Majesty,"
Evans replied, his moustache twitching in alarm.
I am suggesting it,"
Lady Andrews announced, stepping forward.
Property rights have always been inviolate in the Tierling.
Be careful, Lady Andrews. No one is violating your property rights.
They cross our lands.
So did the shipment once a month.
It must have done a good bit of damage to your roadways.
But you did not complain then.
I profited.
Precisely. So let's talk about what's really at stake here. Not right to property, but right to profit.
Profit is where we find it, Majesty.
Is that a threat?
No one is threatening, Your Majesty,
Lord Williams cried. He looked around to the group behind him, and several of them nodded frantically.
Lady Andrews does not speak for all of us, Majesty. We simply wish to minimize the damage to our lands.
Lady Andrews rounded on him.
If you had any balls at all, Williams, I would not have needed to attend this farce.
Keep it civil,
Mace barked. But the admonishment sounded automatic, and Kelsey suspected that Mace was enjoying himself. At some point, Majesty, Lady Andrews continued, the Mort will have to cross my lands. I can make it difficult for them, or I can stand aside.
Kelsey stared at her. Did you just tell me you mean to commit treason? Here, in front of 30 witnesses?
I have no such intention, Majesty.
Not unless I'm forced to it.
Forced to it, Kelsey repeated, grimacing. I know how you conduct yourself in wartime, Lady Andrews. You'll probably greet General Jeannot himself with a glass of whiskey and a free fuck.
Lady,
Mace pleaded.
Majesty, I beg you, Lord Williams interrupted. Please do not take Lady Andrews' word as representative.
Be quiet, Williams, Kelsey replied. I understand what Lady Andrews is about here.
Lady Andrews had begun to examine her nails, as though she found Kelsey uninteresting.
You all have property rights, for certain. But property rights are not inviolate, not in my tier. These people must be evacuated, and their safety is more important than your profit. Try to stand on your rights in this matter, and watch me bring out the principle of eminent domain.
Several of the nobles gasped, but Lady Andrews merely looked up at Kelsey, bewildered. Lord Williams grabbed Lady Andrews' arm and began to hiss in her ear. She shook him off. I will do my best to curtail the looting, Kelsey continued. But if any of you, she looked around the group of nobles, any of you hinder the evacuation in any way, I will not even think twice before I seize your lands for the greater good.
Do you understand me?
We understand, Majesty, Lord William bleated. Believe me, thank you for doing what you can.
He tugged Lady Andrews away from the throne, but she shook him off again, staring up at Kelsey with eyes like daggers.
She's bluffing, Williams. She wouldn't dare. Without the support of the nobles, she has nothing.
Kelsey smiled. What do I care for your support?
If we abandon the monarchy, Kelsey Raleigh.
My name is Glynn.
If we abandon you, then you have no money, no protection, no structure. Even your army is shaky. Without us, what do you have?
The people. The people. Lady Andrews mimicked.
They'd as soon kill any highborn as look at us. Without force or arms or gold, you're as vulnerable as the rest.
My heart flutters.
You're taking my threat lightly. That's an error.
No. Your threat is real enough, Kelsey admitted after a moment's thought. But your overestimation of your own importance is staggering. I knew it the first moment I ever laid eyes on you.
She returned her attention to the rest of them. I'm sorry for the inevitable impact on your profits.
You will simply have to content yourself with a bit less gold on your clothing this year and hope the strain doesn't become too much. Get out.
The nobles turned and moved off toward the doors. Some of their faces betrayed anger, but most of them only looked a bit bewildered, as though the ground had shifted beneath their feet.
Kelsey gave a great sigh of impatience, and that seemed to hurry them onward.
"Wondrous diplomacy, lady,"
Mace muttered.
You realize you only make my job more difficult.
I'm truly sorry for that, Lazarus.
You need the support of your nobles.
I disagree.
They keep the public in line, lady. The people blame the nobles and their overseers for their problems. Remove that buffer, and they might start looking higher up the chain.
And if their eyes come to rest on me, I will deserve that. Mace shook his head.
You're too absolutist for power politics, lady. Who cares if your nobles are hypocrites? They serve a function for you, and a useful one.
Parasites, Kelsey remarked. But the retreating group had reminded her again of Lily Mayhew. Lily had lived in a town with walls, high walls built to keep out the poor. And yet both she and her husband still had to be afraid of the world outside. Was Kelsey any better? Mace and Arliss had ordered the construction of an enormous temporary camp just outside of New London's walls to house the refugees. But if the Mort came, these refugees would have to be moved inside the city. Probably into the keep itself, since New London was already stuffed to bursting. Would Kelsey mind having them there? She thought for a moment, and realized with some relief that she would not.
Now I'll have to keep an eye on all of these fops, Mace continued, looking troubled. I doubt any of them would open direct negotiations with Mort Mayne, but they could do so through an intermediary.
What intermediary?
Most nobles are church-going folk, lady. The Andrews woman is a regular guest in the Arvath. And the new Holy Father is no admirer of yours.
Are you spying on the church?
I keep myself informed, lady. The new Holy Father has already sent several messages to Domain.
For what purpose?
I don't know yet.
That Andrews bitch is no more devout than I am, Lazarus.
And when has that ever stopped anyone from being a pillar of the church?
Kelsey had no answer. Isha. Marguerite was teaching them fractions, and Isha was bored. School was harder to get through on the days when she hadn't had enough sleep the night before. The air of the schoolroom always seemed too warm, and it put Isha into a semi-doze, awake and asleep at the same time. 2/5, Isha answered, feeling smug. Marguerite had been trying to catch her napping. Marguerite, who liked all children, didn't like Isha at all. Isha seemed to create instinctive distrust in adults, as though they could sense that she was watching them, looking for errors and inconsistencies. But it was frustratingly hard to find mistakes in Marguerite. She was too pretty, and Isha gathered from overheard conversations that she had been the regent's concubine. But even Isha had to admit that neither of these things was Marguerite's fault. Something prodded Isha sharply in the ribs. Matthew, sitting behind her, nudging with his foot where Marguerite couldn't see. After a few more pokes, Isha turned around, baring her teeth. Matthew smiled wide, a malicious smile that spoke volumes. He had achieved his objective, broken Isha out of her head. Her brother was the worst sort of bully. One who couldn't stand the sight of other people sitting quietly and contentedly. One who simply had to ruin things. Maman made allowances for Matthew, said that Da had been hard on him, and he wasn't equipped to handle it well. Isha thought that was nonsense. She had taken the worst from Da. Even Wen admitted that, but it hadn't turned her into a little prick who couldn't leave other people alone. Matthew's foot nudged her again, digging right into the space between her ribs. Something struck inside Isha, a thick, deep, gong-like reverberation, and before she could think, she whipped around and flung herself on Matthew, punching and kicking. He shook her off and ran, and without thinking, Isha got up and ran after him, out the door and into the hallway. Matthew was a year older and much bigger, but Isha was quicker. And just as Matthew reached the end of the hallway, she launched herself at him and brought him down. They fell to the stone floor together, Matthew screaming and Isha snarling. She got a fist up into Matthew's throat, making him cough and gag, then bloodied his nose with a good hard slap from the heel of her hand. She loved the sight of the blood against Matthew's white, frightened face. But then a man's hands were locked beneath her arms, hauling her backward. Isher kicked her heels, but she could get no leverage on the smooth stone of the floor. None of this seemed real. Even when Isher looked up and saw Maman, the queen, the rest of the guard, the wide eyes of the crowd assembled in the audience chamber. It seemed only another phase of the insomnia, the hours before sleep that caught Isher like a long, continuous fever dream. Any moment now she would sit up in the dark, mouth dry and heart pounding, and be pleased that nothing truly terrible had happened before she jerked awake.
"Majesty, I apologize."
Maman, apologizing for her. She had embarrassed Maman. The queen merely shook her head, but Isher could sense irritation in the gesture, and this was almost as bad. Marguerite had arrived in the audience chamber now, and she bent over Matthew, shooting Isher a venomous look as she did so. Whoever had laid hold of Isher was now dragging her backward toward the hallway, and Isher's mind conjured up a rogue memory of Dar, who always pulled and tugged.
"Let go!"
"Shut up, brat." The mace, Isher realized, and that brought home the seriousness of what she had just done. She planted her heels on the ground, but that was no help. The mace simply took one of Isher's arms and swung her around, clamping her wrist in an iron grip and dragging her down the hallway.
Where was Maman?
Isher wondered frantically. Memory was growing stronger and stronger, overtaking fact. The mace even smelled like Dar at the end of the day, sweat and iron, and Isher couldn't go with him. She dug her heels in again, and when the mace turned, she brought her foot up and around, launching a kick into his stomach. It caught him squarely, and even in her fright, Isher felt a brief moment of satisfaction. It was no small thing to sneak a move on the captain of guard. The mace coughed and bent double, but his other arm snapped forward and flung Isher against the wall. She hit hard on her shoulder, bounced off, and staggered to the ground, black spots in front of her eyes. It took her a few seconds to recover, but Isher came up ready prepared to kick and scratch. But the mace was leaning against the opposite wall, one hand on his stomach, watching her with the same speculative gaze. "You have a great deal of anger in you, girl."
"So?"
"Anger is a liability for a fighter. I've seen it many times. If he doesn't let the anger go, or at least harness and drive it, it brings him down."
"What do I care?"
"See here." The mace detached himself from the wall, his bulky frame towering over hers, and Isher tensed, preparing. But he merely pointed to her foot. "A kick in the guts is good, but you didn't plan it well, and so I wasn't disabled. In a real fight, you'd be dead now. What you want to do is point your toe, catch me with the tip rather than the arch or ankle, knock the wind out of me. It's very few men who can keep fighting without breath. Point your toe hard enough, and you could even damage one of my organs. As it is, all I'll have is a good-sized bruise." Isher considered this for a moment, sneaking a glance at her own feet. She never planned anything, it just happened, actions exploding out of her.
"Still, I hurt you."
"And what of that? Any man in this wing can keep fighting through much worse. I watched the queen finish her crowning with a knife stuck in her back. Pain only disables the weak." Pain only disables the weak. The words struck a chord inside Isher, making her think of all those years under Dar's roof. When and Matthew each had broken bones, and Wen's shoulder had never healed properly, giving him a strange, slightly hunched appearance when he tried to stand up straight. Maman had taken so many beatings that some of her bruises never went away. And Isher and Morin.
pain only disables the weak.
Come along, Hellcat.
The mace resumed his course down the corridor, rubbing his stomach.
I want to show you something.
Isha followed him cautiously, a few feet behind. She had never been so far down the hall. It was mostly the guards and their families down here. Near the end, the mace opened one of the doors and swung it wide.
Have a look.
Warily, keeping an eye on him, Isha peeked around the doorway and blinked in surprise. She had never seen so much metal in one place before. The entire room gleamed in the torchlight. The arms room, she breathed, her eyes wide.
Welcome to my domain.
A tall, lanky man with a hooked nose emerged from behind a table on the other side of the room. Isha recognized him. Venner, the arms master. Even on the rare occasions when he emerged into the audience chamber, he always had a weapon in his hands, sword or knife or bow, fine-tuning them as though they were musical instruments.
Come inside, child.
Isha only hesitated for a moment. Children were never allowed in the arms room. Wen would be so jealous. Even Matthew would be jealous, though he would try to hide it with scorn. Swords and knives covered the tables. Armory sets hung on the walls. There were even some long, twisted metal weapons, taller than a man, which rested against the wall, pointing toward the sky. Several maces, a rack of bows, their wood a deep, polished bronze, and bundles of tied sticks that Isha eventually recognized as arrows. Hundreds and hundreds of them piled in the corner. So much weaponry. And then Isha realized what this stockpile was for. Siege. Maman had explained siege, but only to Isha and Wen. Maman thought the Mort army would reach New London by autumn. The mace had followed her into the room, and now he paused beside a table that held row after row of knives.
You can't keep starting brawls with the other children. It's a distraction we don't need.
It only distracts Marguerite.
Today it distracted everyone. Your little squabbles are both noisy and dangerous.
Isha flushed. She added up the number of fights she'd been in since they'd come to the keep, and her cheeks burned brighter. Did they all think she was a brat? The mace's gaze was hard, almost contemptuous. He was waiting for her to make an excuse. She would surprise him, just as she had caught him off guard with a kick to the stomach. Sometimes the anger runs me, and I can't control it. I hit and kick before I know what I'm doing. The mace settled back on his heels, his mouth crimping in a small smile.
That's a strong admission. Many men refuse to face the fact of their anger.
Maybe it helps that I'm not a man.
In this room it won't matter,
Venner interrupted, striding forward.
It's a lesson I learned from the Queen. Here, you're a fighter, and I would treat you like one.
Isha looked up, instantly suspicious, and found Venner holding out a knife on one palm, offering her the hilt.
What do you say, Hellcat?
The mace asked.
Want to learn?
Isha looked at the room around her, the weapons piled everywhere, the walls hung with metal. She used to spend days of her childhood fearing that Dar's shadow would appear on the ground beside her, and when she looked up to find him standing there, her stomach would fall to pieces. Staring at Venner and the mace, Isha saw that their faces were hard, yes, and grim. But she saw none of Dar's meanness there. None of his taking. She reached out and grasped the knife. Chapter 3. Ducarte.
In an era rife with butchery, we must still make special mention of Benin Ducarte.
The Tierling as a military nation, Callow the Martyr.
Where is he?
The Queen heard the peevish edge in her own voice. That was bad, but she couldn't help it.
"He'll be here, Majesty," Lieutenant Vallée replied in a quiet voice.
The lieutenant was new to her Security Council, a replacement after the death of Jean Dowell, and he always seemed to be on the edge of things, afraid to speak up. The Queen, who usually valued restraint, found the new lieutenant's tiptoeing manner irritating and signalled him to be silent.
"I wasn't speaking to you. Martin?"
Lieutenant Martin nodded in agreement.
"He'll be here shortly, Majesty. The message said that urgent business delayed him."
The Queen frowned. 10 men were seated in a semicircle in front of her throne. All of them looked exhausted, and none more so than Martin. For the past month, he'd been in the north, putting down unrest in Cité Marche. Hundreds of people had planted themselves in front of the auctioneer's office and refused to move until the Crown addressed the economic conditions in the city.
It was irritating, but nothing to really contend with.
They had no leader, these radicals, and rebellion without a leader was like a tidal wave. It went like hell until it met a cliff wall. The rebellion in Calais had failed in a similar fashion when its momentum simply petered out. But the fighting in Cité Marche had been hard, with several soldiers killed. There was no doubt that many of these men could use some rest. After this meeting, she would give some of them a few days off. But the meeting couldn't begin without Ducat. Her chief of internal security was no doubt more exhausted than any of them. His men had spent weeks trying to figure out who was organizing the protests in Cité Marche with no answers yet. But Ducat would get results eventually. He always did. Physically, he was beginning to show his age, but there wasn't a more skilled interrogator in Mortmain. The Queen tapped her nails on the arm of her throne, her fingers going automatically to her breastbone. They seemed to go there all the time of their own accord. It had, in fact, become a tick, and the Queen of Mortmain had no ticks. Such things were for the weak and mindless. The invasion of the Tierling had begun in disaster. Word had reached the Palais a week earlier. Her army had been taken by surprise and scattered throughout the Mort flats. It would take weeks to reassemble the soldiers and clear the camp. The entire thing was a catastrophe, but there was no one on whom the Queen could unleash her fury. General Junot had simply disappeared. More than 1,000 Mort soldiers had died on the flats, but Junot's body hadn't been among the corpses. "He'd better pray he's dead, if I find him." Movement to her right drew her attention. A slave was kneeling in front of the fireplace, lining the base with paper.
"What do you think you're doing?"
The slave looked up, her eyes wide, terrified, yet resentful. Tyr. There could be no doubt of it. Although she was dark-haired and quite beautiful, she had the sullen, stupid expression of a Tyr peasant. The Queen switched languages.
"No fireplace is to be used within this building."
The girl swallowed and replied in Tyr,
"I'm sorry, Majesty. I didn't know."
Was that possible? The Queen had given a blanket order about fires.
She would have to speak to Beryl about it.
"What's your name, slave?"
"Emily."
She even pronounced it in the Tyr fashion, without accent.
"Be the last to know again, Emily, and you'll find yourself for sale on the streets."
The slave nodded, gathered up the paper from the fireplace, and stuffed it back in the bucket, then stood waiting with a bewildered expression that only irritated the Queen further.
"Get out!"
The girl left. The Queen sensed her Security Council's eyes on her, questioning. The throne room was cold this morning. No doubt many of them wondered why there was no fire. But the only fires the Queen allowed now were torches and the ovens in the Palais kitchens, some 20 floors below. Not even to Beryl could she admit the truth. She was frightened. In the past 2 months, disturbing rumours had begun to trickle in from the Fairwitch. Miners taken, children disappearing, even an entire family that had simply vanished from a home at the base of the foothills. The dark thing was always hungry, The Queen knew that better than anyone. But something had changed. It had always been satisfied with explorers and fortune hunters, those foolish enough to venture into the Fair Witch proper. Now it was expanding its hunting grounds. But how? That was the real question. The Queen didn't know the whole of the Dark Thing's strange history, but there was no doubt that it was bound to the Fair Witch, enspelled there in some way. It could only travel by fire, and even that effort could exhaust its abilities. So how had it managed to take an entire family in Arknor without leaving a trace? Has it gotten free? The Queen quailed at the thought. The Dark Thing had forbidden her to invade the Tierling, and by now it would know that she had disobeyed. But what choice did she have? Left unpunished, the delinquent Tier's shipment was an incitement to every revolutionary in the New World. The riots in Cité Marche were only the latest example. The last Carrerie's shipment had contained goods of markedly diminished quality. Poorly insulated glass, defective horses, second-rate gems, whose surfaces revealed multiple flaws. In Calais, silk production had dropped to such a low level that it could only mean deliberate sabotage. These signs were easy to interpret. Fear, that powerful engine that drove the Mort economy, was waning. The Queen had to invade the Tierling, if for no other reason than demonstration. An object lesson, as Thorne would say. But she had disobeyed the Dark Thing, and by now it had surely found her out. Damping the fireplaces was a temporary measure, one that could not work forever. "It doesn't matter," her mind insisted. "She would invade the Tierling, and do what she should have done years ago. Take the sapphires." The reports from the Argive Pass, though still spotty and unconfirmed, made her course very clear. The Tier sapphires still had power, all right, and once the Queen had them, she would tear through the New World like a hurricane. She would light all the fires she wanted, and even the Dark Thing would cower from her sight. But still she was worried. Thorne had vanished. It was a special gift of his, disappearing without a trace. But her guard captain, Ghislaine, had evaluated Thorne correctly long ago. "Dangerous, Majesty, always, even if he stands before you wearing nothing." She wished she knew where he was. None of her military men were brave enough to ask about the fireplace. Valet's mouth still held a hint of sullen displeasure at being silenced earlier. His pout, that of a small boy, denied a sweet. "Children," the Queen thought grimly. "My soldiers are all children." A throat cleared behind her, such a perfect mixture of signal and respect that it could only be Beryl.
"Majesty, Descartes has arrived. He will be here shortly."
The Queen nodded, but her eyes remained on the darkened fireplace. She thought she'd heard something over there, a soft hiss like the sparking of a flame. Her patience had shortened, and she found herself unwilling to wait for Descartes even a moment longer. "Let's begin. What of the Cité Marche?"
"The rebels are contained, Majesty," Martin replied. "For now, at least." "Let's not call them rebels," Vice interrupted. "Let's call them adolescents with too much time and money on their hands."
Martin shook his head.
"I would advise caution in that assessment. We found many overfed young people, yes, and most of these ran at the first sign of real conflict. But we also found a considerable number of idle poor, apparently directed by a man named Levieux. Several of those we took into custody died hard without even revealing his name."
"What else?"
"Barely anything, Majesty. None of them had much information to give. No one had ever seen Levieux's face, only received orders through intermediaries. He seems to be operating from outside Cité Marche."
"That's all?"
"That's all they had, Majesty, I promise you. They didn't know anything. Thus,
my caution. The rabble may have found a leader, someone who knows how to organize. That would be a serious development.